Well, welcome. This week we're talking about personalities, and maybe you're somebody that's been described as somebody that doesn't have a personality, and if that's true, it's not true about you, because we all have a personality. We all have a very unique personality, and they play into relationships in incredible ways. And so tonight we're going to start by talking about what are personalities and how do we get them. And most of us, when we got married, very few of us actually knew much about personalities. We really didn't know or understand our spouse's personality. And interestingly, when two people are attracted to each other, it's often the other person's personality that becomes the thing that we're attracted to. And then over time we get married, and then it's that very same personality that begins to frustrate us about the other person. And so because we love them, we set out on a course to change them. And so we get frustrated. So, for example, the neat perfectionist woman falls in love with the carefree, spontaneous guy because he brings the sense of excitement and fun to her life. And then she later discovers that in addition to being fun and spontaneous, he's also unorganized and doesn't care, doesn't make his bed or pick up his dirty underwear, begins to forget stuff like appointments and anniversaries. And she thinks to herself, that's okay, because I'll change him. I'll love him through this. He can get this part of his life right. You know, I can love him through it. And he thinks at the same time, well, she'll change. She's just a little uptight. She just needs to loosen up and enjoy life a little bit more. But I can love her through this. And both become frustrated then that the other person doesn't change. What they don't realize is that what they've grown to know about each other are not character flaws, they're personality traits. And so this has been huge for me because one time, Karen and I were on vacation, gosh, a number of years ago, and I remember one morning I was up in, we were in a condominium that we'd rented, and I was just up in the room and doing some work and some studying, and she had gone down to the pool, and she was going to read by the pool. And if you need to understand, if you've met my wife, she's an introvert. She's pretty quiet. And we're at a place that we didn't know anybody. Okay, so this isn't like she would have run into somebody that she knew. And I hear her laughing out loud. And that just kind of struck me because that's unusual for her. And so I go over to the balcony to our room and I look out over the pool to see who in the world is my wife talking to and what is so funny. And I look down and there is nobody else there. She is there completely by herself. She's sitting in a lounge chair by the pool reading this book, and she's laughing out loud. And I said, Karen, what is so funny? And she goes, you, I'm reading about you. And of course, that piqued my curiosity. And so that vacation, we read this book together, a book called Your Personality Tree by Florence Littauer, and it changed our marriage. And we weren't parents yet, but then when our kids came along, it marked how we parent our kids. It influences our relationships in the workplace, everything else that we do. And so this understanding of personalities, it became a time, what changed for Karen and I was that it began to kind of reverse the trend that we were getting increasingly frustrated with the other person in our relationship. And it really began the process of beginning to understand the differences and appreciate the differences in each other. And probably a day doesn't go by that the stuff that we learned in this book and in this process doesn't come to mind and affect what we say, what we do, how we treat each other, what we draw out of the other person. And so this has been hugely, hugely helpful. So Florence Littauer wrote this book called Your Personality Tree. And a lot of the content that we come from tonight, the profile that we took, comes out of this book. I would highly recommend this for anybody. It's one of those, like, if you're going to have, I think I've said this before, if there's five books that you could have as a married couple or in relationships, this is one of the ones that I would start with. Now, in addition to that, Florence has written several other follow-up books. One is called Personality Plus for Couples, Understanding Yourself and the One You Love. And so a lot about relationships and marriage in this book. And so a lot of the content for tonight even comes out of the Personality Plus for Couples. She wrote a book called Personality Plus for Parents, Applying the Personality Models to Your Parenting. That's a great book. And then a really intriguing book that she wrote with her daughter called Personality Puzzle, Piecing Together Personalities in Your Workplace. And this is actually a book that talks about understanding personalities as it relates to the people that you work with, the people that you work for, the people that work for you. And that's a great, great resource for personalities in the workplace. All right, so a lot of the content comes from that. But understanding personalities goes way back. In fact, it was the Greek philosopher Hippocrates back 400 BC that began to notice, as he was observing people, that people had different personalities. And as he began to kind of study that, he noticed that they kind of fell into four major groupings of personalities. And at the time, his hypothesis was that we got the different personalities based on body fluids and different levels of body fluids that we have. And so he named the four personalities after the four body fluids. And so the four distinct personalities and the names that we have, you know, thousands of years later have still stuck. So the personalities that we talk about tonight, the original, because they're titled, they're named things that you probably haven't heard before. Sanguine, choleric, phlegmatic, melancholy are actually the names that Hippocrates gave them, the personalities, based on the, you know, how they equated to those body fluids, okay? That we've since come to understand, I hope you realize, that it has nothing to do with body fluids. But the names have stuck, okay? And so although you haven't heard those names before, probably the one you've heard before is the word melancholy, okay? So those of you that scored really high in melancholy, you're not real happy about that because you're thinking, I don't want to be a melancholy because melancholy means sad, and I don't. But that's not what it means here, okay? And for our uses, our purposes, it's just the name of one of the personalities, and we'll see how that gets going. How we get them. Well, we were born with them. You know, it's not environment. Your personality doesn't change. You can't intentionally change your personality. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get through part of the teaching. But look at what the Bible says about that. That's at the top of your handout. God says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. So we know that God created us. He created us in our mother's womb. And he says, before I even formed you in the womb, I knew you. I knew who you were. And so God imparts a personality to us, and we're born with that personality. And those of you that have had multiple kids, especially if you've had multiple kids, if you had just one, you understand, you probably quickly learned that child's personality. But if you've had multiple kids, you understand that you may have two or three kids who were born in the exact same environment, the same genetics, the same parents, the same living situation, all those same factors the same, but the kids have very, very different personalities. From the moment they're in, you know, a car seat or in their, you know, baby carrier, you notice that some are just content to just look around and happy when everybody's in the room. And some are like reaching for stuff like, and they're always trying to do something. And some are just fussy. And so you realize that nobody taught them those things. There's just this innate personality that God imparted to them and that they were born with. And, you know, you've probably heard the expression, you know, no two people on the planet are the same, which I believe is absolutely true. God created you uniquely. But so often when we hear that phrase, no two of us are the same, we think in terms of our physical appearance, right? But I think it's way more than that, because the reality is, you know, there aren't that many different features that we have. We have what? Two eyes, a nose, a mouth, two ears. There's only so many ways you can configure a human face. In fact, if you've ever seen like celebrity look-alike contests, it's amazing how close some people look to what other people look like. And so my guess is if we, you know, and with billions of people in the world, we could find quite a few people who look almost exactly like you. And maybe we wouldn't even be able to tell you apart. So it has something to do with way more than just our physical appearance, and it mostly is about our personality. And so while Hippocrates said that you could kind of generally categorize personalities into four major groupings, even if we put, you know, okay, all of you that are sanguines, you go to that corner, and melancholy's here, and choleric's here, phlegmatic's here, the people in the corner with you, even though they share that same big grouping, you would be nothing like them, because all of us are this unique combination of the four personalities And so you yourself are very unique. Although the categories help us get to know some about each other and are especially helpful when we start talking about relationships. Now, I understand that there's other personality models besides this. And you may have, you may be familiar, some of the most familiar ones are the Myers-Briggs. I'm an ENFP, although I would have to stop and think about it to know what that really means. There's some that are much more intricate and detailed. There's the Enneagram model, which I think has some great attributes to it. This model that we're going to do, one of the reasons why we teach this and why I am so sold on this is that in this one session, you will be able to learn this model in a way that I think you will be able to use daily for the rest of your life. And it's the most helpful, it's the simplest, the most helpful, the most practical model that I think we have to be able to understand our personalities and other people's personalities. And so that's why we're using this one. We're not saying it's the only or the best or anything else, okay? And it's a model that has four basic personalities. And as I said, the titles are sanguine, choleric, melancholy, and phlegmatic. And you see in your notes a grid that looks something like this. And the grid is important. And as we talk about it, you'll see that you probably, when you did the profile, there was one number that jumped up that was higher than all the other numbers. That's your primary personality. So maybe sanguine was your highest number, okay? Or melancholy was your highest number. And then there generally, usually is a secondary number. We'll call it a backup personality style. And most of the time, it's right next to your primary one. So if your highest score was in melancholy, your secondary score was probably either in phlegmatic or choleric. Okay, and so we would say, so my highest is sanguine and my second is choleric. So I would say I'm a sanguine choleric. That's my personality type is sanguine choleric. I'm primarily sanguine, but I also have a lot of choleric. Okay, and so, we'll talk about that as we go through and as we look at that. So what I want to do now is I want to just kind of look through that. And the other thing that you need to know too is that the grid is important in that your secondary style is next to it. But the opposite corners, are opposite personalities as well. So a melancholy personality is actually the opposite of a sanguine personality. And choleric is the opposite of phlegmatic, and we'll see how all that works. All right? So here we go. This is going to be fun. All right. Sanguines. We'll start with sanguines. How many of you scored highest in sanguine? Anybody in here with me? Yes. All right, the sanguines in the group. This is great, okay? Sanguines are fun-loving, outgoing, sunny personalities who tend to draw people to themselves because they always just seem to be having such a good time. Sanguines are optimistic. Sanguines are good up front. They tend to be, they're very spontaneous. They often are funny. In a word, their desire and goal in life is to have fun. Bottom line, when it comes right down to it for a sanguine, we just want to all be having fun, right? Sanguines are a party waiting to happen. With other people, sanguines are the motivators, they're encouragers, they're upbeat. Sanguines are storytellers. Sanguines love to tell stories, okay? So if you are a sanguine, you're married to a sanguine, you know a sanguine. My wife would tell you, sanguines never let the facts get in the way of a good story, okay? And sanguines, we love to tell stories about ourselves, and often the more embarrassing, the better, okay? So, like, if I, got up in the morning and went out to get the paper off the front porch, and I opened up the door, and the neighbor lady across the street waved and said, "Hi, Gordy," and I said, "Hi, how are you? Good morning," and I went back inside and realized that I had just gone outside and said hi to the neighbor lady, and I was in my boxer shorts, I would be, terribly embarrassed. But I would come to work, and the first thing I would do is gather people and go, "You got to hear what happened," okay? And so when we do something embarrassing, the first thing we want to do is we want to tell somebody, we want to talk about it, okay? There was a time here at church we were doing a video teaching of Mike Breaux that particular weekend, and I remember I was in my office, and I was talking to Craig Day. The message was going on. I have a screen in my office, and I was supposed to go up and close the service after the video, and I'm in my office talking to Craig, and I'm watching a screen out of the corner of my eye so I know when to go up, and I realized we're at a part of the message. I said to Craig, "I got to get out there because the message is almost over." So I'm walking out, I'm adjusting my microphone, walking out of the office. I get to the hallway, and I look up in the hallway, and the monitors out in the hallways, all I see is an empty stage. And I'm like, "Oh, crap." Okay? So I run to the doors of the auditorium. I open the doors of the auditorium, and here is like hundreds of people sitting in the auditorium, just dead silent. And there's just, the lights are on the stage, and there's nobody up there. Okay?
So this had been like this for about 30 seconds or more, I guess. And so everybody knew what was going on. And so I just kind of ran up the aisle and everybody's just howling, laughing, okay? My supervisor, my boss, happened to be out of town that weekend, which was very fortunate for me. But when he got back, the first thing I said is, you got to hear what happened this weekend. And he's like, I already heard, okay? So, but we do something like that, and most people would just be mortified by it. You know, sanguines, we just kind of laugh it off and go, okay, I did it again, and then we can't wait to tell somebody else about it, all right? Sanguines never met a stranger. We're great with first impressions. We love meeting new people. Most people love meeting sanguines. But at the same time, we can be disorganized. Sanguines can forget appointments. Sanguines forget commitments. Because remember, everything in their life is marked by spontaneity. And sanguines lose their keys because they don't put the keys in the same place every time. One of our downsides is that sanguines tend to talk too much. I have to be very careful. In a meeting, in a group of people just talking, the tendency of a sanguine is just to talk too much. And so I have to be very intentional about not doing that, all right? Sanguines are risk takers. We don't mind doing, again, it kind of comes out of that spontaneous, let's try something. And so even taking risks, sanguines are more adaptable to doing that. Here's what sanguines need to learn. Sanguines need to learn that deadlines are not merely suggestions, okay? Not everything in life is marked by spontaneity and flexibility. And there are times that we need to succumb to, you know, or to, you know, follow rules and procedures and deadlines. The other thing that's true about sanguines is that sanguines need to be careful that they don't succumb to peer pressure, because one of the strong needs of a sanguine is a need to be liked, okay? And so I'm not like proud of that, but the reality is there's a lot in my life that I kind of measure over wanting people to like me. And I need to, so sanguines need to be careful that we don't go down paths in our life that take us down places that we really don't want or shouldn't go simply because we want to be accepted or liked by the people around us, okay? So that's sanguines. Across from the sanguines are the people that they usually marry, okay? The melancholies. How many melancholies do we have in here? Show of hands. Yeah, lots of melancholies. Okay, that's great. My wife is a melancholy. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit about McCarran. You know, when you did the profile, there was 40 possible points, and so the total of your four usually adds 40. Karen scored 38 in melancholy, okay, and only one in two of the others. And I think that that wasn't even accurate. I think she's probably even higher. She is totally melancholy, okay, and so it's made for some interesting things in our marriage, okay. So opposite of the fun-loving sanguines are the ones that they usually marry, the melancholies, who are deep and thoughtful and introspective. They're serious about life. Their desire and goal, whereas the sanguines want to have fun, is they want to have order. A place for everything and everything in its place, right, melancholies? That's kind of how we do life. Another way to say it is they want to have it right. Melancholies kind of look at right life and go, no, it's got to be right, and this isn't right. And so melancholies have this mantra, this kind of motto that they go by, that melancholies will be able to finish this for me. A job worth doing is worth doing right or well, okay? A job worth doing is worth doing right or well, okay? Which means the melancholies are the perfectionists among us. They can be perfectionists. There's a way to do everything, and we got to do it right. They're the detail people. And so one of the great things for Karen and I is that Karen will always pay attention to the details that I would never even care about or notice and do that kind of thing. So they have a need for order and structure in their lives, in their homes, in everything that they do. I remember early on in our marriage coming home one day from work, and Karen was just, you know, kind of down a little bit, and I just said, what's going on? And she said, I'm just having a bad day. And I went, oh, really? What happened? What's going on? And she goes, well, because the house is just a mess. That made no sense to me whatsoever, okay? On the one hand, you're having a bad day. I'm sorry about that. On the other hand, the house is a mess. How in the world are those two connected? But for her, for a melancholy, there's an emotional connection to things not being in order. And I thought she just needed counseling. It's like, what, how do you know? I like houses that aren't messy too, but I have no emotional connection to that whatsoever, okay? I like order and structure, but again, I've never had a bad day because of a lack of order or structure. Not true for melancholies, because melancholies like order and structure. They like predictability. They don't like surprises. They like stability. They like plans and lists, okay? Melancholies are the ones that make the grocery lists before they go. In fact, I know melancholies that make a list in the morning of everything they want to get done that day, and they check it off, okay? I actually went to a planning, a time management seminar one time with the guy who was like the VP of Daytimers, and I'm with all these colleagues and we're learning how to better plan our day. So he taught us this whole system of making a list of what you're going to do at the beginning of the day and then checking it off as you do. And that was just so humiliating for me because I went through like a month of doing exactly what they asked me to do. And I get to the end of the day and nothing was checked off. Or like two things, which meant the next day I had to carry all those things over and write them on the next page and do it all over again. And the list just got bigger and bigger. And finally I realized, and this is very sanguine of me, I finally realized that what I needed to do was not write anything down until the end of the day and then write down everything that I did and put a check mark by it and then go, yep, it was a good day. So melancholies make the list, though, of what they want to get done during the day. Melancholies make grocery lists, and then they rewrite the grocery list so they can read it better, and then they put it in the order of, like, produce first, because that's where we're going to go first, and that kind of stuff. Okay, I go to the grocery store with a general idea of what we need. And I think, of course, sanguines think this way. I think in terms of what we're going to do with the food. Okay, so we're going to have dinner. Oh, that'll be fun. And so we need these things for dinner. And I'll get most of them. I'll remember most of them. But I am the one that goes shopping. I go to the grocery store almost every day to get the things that I didn't get before that we need for today. Okay, so melancholies are organized. They love to organize things. I remember we remodeled our kitchen several years ago. And, of course, we had to move everything out of the kitchen, put everything in boxes, and then tear it out, put all new cabinets, all kinds of stuff. Okay. When it came time to put everything back, of course, it's different cupboards. So now you got to figure out a whole new system of where everything goes. Karen just looked at me and said, stay away from the kitchen. Okay. I said, no, I'll help. I got boxes. She said, no, I'll figure out where it goes. For her, she loved doing that. She loved figuring out where everything went, and it was, and I'm glad that she did that, because the sanguine approach to that would be, I would have put stuff in drawers, they would have all been in the wrong drawers, and if it had been up to me, they probably would end up staying in those same drawers for 20 years. We would have gotten used to where they are, but they would have all been in the wrong place. So the fact that Karen was able to start from scratch and organize it meant that we have a very, very organized kitchen, okay? So here's probably the best example I can give you of the difference between sanguines and melancholies, and that is going to the grocery store, and let's say I go to the grocery store, and one of the things, and I do most of the grocery shopping for our family, and I do have lists because Karen makes them for me, and I'll go to the grocery store, and maybe on the list is bananas. And so I go to the banana section in produce, and here's the big display of bananas, and they're beautiful bananas, and I go up, and I have an idea of how to pick good bananas, okay? I'm a sanguine, I'm not an idiot, okay? So I know what good bananas are, I know how many we want and what the right ripeness is that we want when we buy them. And so I look, and I pick up a first bunch, and I go, and these are great. Just about the right number, perfect ripeness, and I say, these will do just fine. And I put them in the basket, and I'm off on the rest of the list, okay? Not so if Karen's shopping. If a melancholy comes with that same list, they come with the same list, I want to get bananas, they go to the exact same display of bananas, they pick up the exact same bunch that I picked up, they say these are the right ripeness, about the right number, but they don't say these are fine, they say these might be the right ones. But melancholies, help me here. How do I know if these are the right bananas or not? I have to check every other bunch of bananas on the display. Because while these might be exactly what I think we're looking for, I don't know if they're the right ones until I compare them to every other bunch of bananas on the thing. Because if there's another bunch of bananas that are better than these, then these aren't the right ones. These are the wrong ones, and those are the right ones. Correct, melancholies? Are you with me? Okay. So, but I don't put the bananas back on the display and keep looking. Because God forbid I go around and find out that, come to lo and behold, those were the best ones, but now somebody else has taken those. That could ruin an entire day. And so I take those bananas and I put them in the cart in case. And then I go around and check all the rest of the bananas, and lo and behold, those are the best ones that I could find, and so I keep those. Now, notice what's happened here. The sanguine and the melancholy go away with the exact same bunch of bananas, but a very different process to get there. And that's a great example of how in personalities, we may arrive at the same conclusions, but we have very different processes that our minds go through to get us there, all right? So I was thinking about this week because I was doing some work on my house, and I have a toolbox that I have my tools in most of the time, unless I've left my tools someplace and I can't remember where they are, and that's my own problem. But I think about, you know, a melancholy man with his tools, and I'll be sexist here for a second, a melancholy has the pegboard in the basement of the garage with the outlines of the tools drawn around him, right? So if there is a tool missing, he instantly knows which tool is missing because it's the outline for the pliers or whatever it is, okay? I, on the other hand, have a toolbox where everything's just kind of dumped in there. And a melancholy would say, I know what tool I need. I know exactly where to go to get it. I look through the toolbox and go, it's got to be in here somewhere, that kind of a thing, okay? Now, one of the misconceptions about personalities is that sanguines are the ones that, only ones that like to have fun. Not true. Everybody likes to have fun. The difference is for melancholies to have fun, there has to be a sense of order in order to have fun. And it's hard to have fun if things are, you know, if life is in chaos or in disarray, right? Melancholy. So I remember one time, one of the things that we love to do, we live on the river, we have a boat, we love to go out boating with our boys and have since they were little. And I remember when our boys were younger, one day it was a beautiful summer day and we were sitting at the dinner, at the kitchen table having dinner. Of course, it stays light in the summer so long. So it was, you know, getting a little bit later and I said, hey, what's a beautiful night? Let's go for a boat ride. And the boys are like, yeah. And so forks are flying everywhere and they're halfway out the door. And Karen says, wait, stop. And everybody freezes, and we look back at Karen, and she goes, let's clean up the kitchen before we go. And the boys look at her, and they look at me, and they look at her, and they look at me. And I think just because I wanted to be supportive of Karen, I'm not sure exactly what I said, but I said something very loving and supportive at that point. Like, I think I said something like, are we having company while we're gone? Is there a reason why we need to do that? And she said something which really struck me, and as a sanguine, I would not have thought this at all. She said, no. She said, I want to go and have fun on the boat. I love going for a boat ride with you guys. But it won't be any fun for me if I go on the boat ride knowing we've left the kitchen a mess and we have to come back up and clean it after I get back. That was news to me. And I had this thought. I thought, that may be the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. But I love my wife. Okay, boys, let's clean up the kitchen. So we cleaned up the kitchen. We went for a boat ride. But what really was, that was a pivotal experience for me because I would never have related that idea that to be on the boat, which is fun for me, that it would take away from her experience if in her mind she knows that she's left the kitchen a mess and when we go back, we got to clean up the mess, okay? So for her to have fun, there's got to be a sense of order and structure and things being in order to do that, all right? Melancholies are often musical because if you have studied music, if you're a musician yourself, you know that music is very structured. And so very often, a lot of times, professional musicians and musical people are melancholies. For melancholies, kind of the opposite of sanguines, for melancholies who attempt to tell stories, it's all about the details, okay? It's all about the facts. And so whereas sanguines never let the facts get in the way of a good story, melancholies, it's all about the facts. So a melancholy wants to tell a story and they say, okay, I got to tell you this thing that happened because these six friends of mine, we went out to eat and then there was five of us that went to eat because one wasn't eating. She came later, but there were six total. But actually, when the thing that happened that I'm about to tell you about, the two of them had already left, so there's only four of us there now. So 5 ate, one came in, and then two left. Are you with? And then by then, people are just going, just never mind. Okay. So melancholy is it's all about the details. And I can see Karen, I can just see her squirm, and it bothers her if I'm telling a story and some of the details are wrong, okay? Even insignificant details are wrong, because it's like, well, no, wait a minute, Gordy. You know, and fortunately, she now doesn't tell me till later that night what the mistakes that I made in the story. But melancholies are not risk takers. As I said, they like stability and predictability. They need sensitivity and support from others because often their personality is misunderstood. Their need for order and structure, sometimes people misunderstand that. This one was really helpful for me to understand as somebody who's married to a melancholy. Melancholies require space and time in which to think before they speak, write, or act, okay? So if I ask a melancholy, if I ask Karen an opinion on something, she needs time by herself to kind of process it through and think. Or if we need to make a decision, we were just talking about something this afternoon that we've got to make a decision around holiday that's coming up. And she said, and she started to kind of process it out. But then I realized we were not going to make a decision in that moment. She needs time to go back and now to process it and to think about it, okay? So whereas sanguines, you know, melancholies, they need time to think before they speak. Sanguines just speak. We think out loud. I will say something and then listen to myself say it to decide afterwards if I believe that what I just said was true or not, okay? And so sometimes I have to correct myself. I'll say something and go, well, no, that's not what I believe. Whereas melancholies, and so what that means is in a conversation or a discussion, it's very easy for me as a sanguine to overpower Karen. And because I can process and think out loud right away in the moment. But if I really want to have a productive conversation where she has an equal part in the decision in the conversation, I need to set that up so that she has time to process it and think. And then we come back and have another discussion about it at a later time. Okay. Melancholies have their antennas up for things that are not right. Okay, remember I said sometimes they want to have it right? Melancholies are kind of like this radar looking around, and they notice things that are not right. If you're a melancholy, you're driving down the road, you see a billboard, and there is a spelling error on the billboard, and it drives you crazy. It's like, how do they do that? Don't they have spell check on their billboard making machine or whatever that is? And because melancholies tend to look at any situation and immediately see what's not right about it, that can tend to, I said, you know, melancholy in this case doesn't mean sad, but melancholies are probably more prone to sadness and depression than the other three personalities, just from the standpoint of they have what we call a perfect worldview, which means they look at any situation, any group of people, any room that they walk into, and they right away size up what it should be. And notice what's not as it should be. And that can lead to a level of frustration of why is it not as it should be, okay? And so, one of the things that I've noticed in our marriage, in fact, I've even noticed this recently, I noticed it for years, that because I tend to mispronounce people's names and say words wrong, and I don't really care, and as long as you know what I'm talking about. And so I would be telling a story or telling Karen something or telling a group of people something, and I would say, talk about a person, and if I said their last name, if I mispronounced their last name, in the middle of it, Karen would just stop me and go, well, no, it's this. She would give me the right pronunciation, which drove me crazy. Because to be really honest, I'm thinking, wait a minute, you just interrupted me to correct my pronunciation of their name? Did you not know who I was talking about? No, I knew what you were talking about. Okay, well, then are you saying that what I was talking about was less important than their name and getting it right? I mean, so that kind of stuff just began to frustrate me, okay? So we've talked about that. And so something just happened recently when I was saying something and I said the person's name and I had a pretty good idea that I'd said it wrong. And I looked at Karen and she didn't say anything. And in my mind, and I just kind of kept going, I just kind of chuckled because I thought, unfortunately, this is really bothering her. But I'm thankful that she didn't interrupt me to correct me in the name. But I also knew that we would have a conversation about that later. And I remember, and this even happened recently, and I said, okay, but did you not, but you knew who I was talking about, right? She goes, oh, well, yeah. And I said, so then what difference does it make? And she said, well, I wouldn't want you to get it wrong, you know, when you're talking to them or, you know, something like that. And so her reasoning's all correct, but that level of it's not right just tends to bother melancholies, okay? And so that perfectionist side of them can make them actually critical and pessimistic. And so they need to be really, really careful of that. And so what melancholies need to learn, whereas sanguines need to learn that deadlines are not suggestions, melancholies need to learn that that model that they live by, a job worth doing is worth doing right, is not true. And don't throw anything at me, melancholies, but here's what melancholies need to understand. By definition, a job worth doing is worth doing poorly. Now, I'm not advocating that anybody, and I know some of you just were ready to walk out when you hear that. Okay, I'm not advocating that we intentionally do things poorly. I think we should intentionally do things with as much excellence as we can. I think that honors God and honors people. But the idea that a job worth doing is worth doing well sometimes becomes debilitating for melancholies. Because if I can't do it well, then I'm not going to do it yet, or I'm not going to do it. And sometimes melancholies don't end up doing things that they should do that need to be done because of the fear that it won't be right or it won't be done well. And I'm saying if it's worth doing, it's worth doing. Whether you do it poorly or well. Again, I'm not saying I intentionally do it poorly. But melancholies can get stuck in that right thinking of, if I can't do it right, then maybe I won't do it at all. All right? Another thing that probably typifies melancholies, and you'll notice this if you're in a relationship with a melancholy, is the use of the word should or the use of the word should not. Most sentences contain the word should, because they look at, well, this is what we should do, and this is what should have happened, and we shouldn't do this, and we should do that. And so this whole parameter of shoulds, they kind of are ruled by the should monster that kind of hovers over them, and that can become debilitating at times. All right, so that's melancholies. And those of us that are sanguines, we love melancholies, and we need them tremendously to add order to our lives. Now, how many cholerics in the crowd? Anybody? Yeah, the clerics are strong. Yeah, me, right here. Okay. If melancholies think that they're right, clerics know that they're right, okay? Clerics are the born leaders. They're the take charge kind of people, okay? Melancholies want to have order. Clerics want to have control. They want to be in charge, okay? Clerics are the decision makers. And like sanguines tell stories with or without the facts, clerics make decisions with or without the facts. Given a situation that needs a decision, clerics will step right in, and I know what we need to do, we'll make a decision, without spending time kind of dissecting the facts and analyzing and all that kind of stuff, okay? So clerics make very quick decisions, but here's what you need to know. Clerics, most of the time, make good decisions. They're good decision makers because God has put that in their personality where they can size up a situation, something that needs to be done, a decision that needs to be made, and they very quickly have an idea, well, this is what we should do. And quite often, they're right. And so they become, in a group, they become the leaders, the chairman, the presidents, the CEOs. And they just want to get work done. They want to get the job done. They don't want to waste time talking about it. So you'll see, if you're in a group discussion about a project or a committee that's trying to decide what to do, the clerics get very frustrated with the process because they're like, let's quit talking about it. Let's just do it. You know, we'll figure it out as we go. That's a choleric statement, okay? And so when Nike came out with the model, just do it, and then all of a sudden it's across the screen of the TV, the clerics are like, yes, somebody, that's my motto. Somebody gets it now. Just do it. Quit talking about it. The melancholies want to analyze. They want to process and all the facts and figures and stuff like that. The clerics just want to get doing it. Now, one of the downsides, one of the drawbacks for clerics is that they often put more emphasis on getting their way than on getting along with others. For them, the task and the decision is often the premium value even more than how other people feel or how they're doing at the time, all right? So my brother is a choleric. I love my brother. He's a wonderful choleric. He's just a born leader, just a natural leader. He's a little bit older than I am. He's led some amazing things in his life, his business and some other things. But that's just how he does life. He just is very, very naturally good at that. Several years ago, I was taking a group of men to the NCAA basketball tournament, the first and second rounds down in Indianapolis. And so the tournament was like a Friday, Sunday. And so on the Friday round, there's two games in the afternoon and then two games in the evening. There's about a two-hour dinner break. Now, my brother had lived in Indianapolis. He was familiar with it all. And so we were talking one time, and he said, is there anything I can do for you? And I said, well, you can maybe help me out, because here's the deal. I've been to these things before, and so I know that, you know, there'll be about a two-hour dinner break between the afternoon session and the evening session. There's not enough time to get in the cars and go back, way back out to the hotel, find something to eat. So we're going to need to walk around downtown Indy and find something to eat. Now, there's going to be 18,000 people that all pour out of that stadium at the same time looking for something to eat. Okay, so the lines will be long. I said, I would love to find a place, you know, and a couple blocks from there was a P.F. Chang's. And I said, that would be a great place for us to go as a group, but there's eight of us. And I said, I called them. They don't take reservations, and they won't take reservations on that night. So we would have to get in line and wait like probably 2 hours just to get a table. So I said, are there other places, you know, what I'm like that would be great for us to eat? He said, let me think about it. Let me ask around. I know some people down there, and call back. He called me back like a half an hour later. He said, well, we got reservations at P.F. Chang's at 7 o'clock. I said, how do you do that? He said, I called him. You know, that's what a choleric would do. Just kind of take charge and go, let me at it. I'll see what I can get done. Okay, so, you know, if those of you that have volunteered in ShareFest before, maybe you've met Joe Vittori. Just a wonderful choleric. Just to take charge. Let's get stuff done. Let's quit talking about it. Here's what we need to do. And faced with a dilemma, like, okay, we got to remodel this entire school. And Joe's like, okay, let's roll up our sleeves. Here we go. This is what we need to do. And then if you've ever been to a shift of ShareFest, you know that you show up and there's, you know, 50 volunteers. And Joe just kind of instantly takes the mic and says, okay, here's what we need. We need 7 guys to go with this guy and do that. Okay, 7, go. And then, you know, and within 3 minutes, we're all divided up into all these different teams and we're working. That's a choleric at his best, just doing what he does really, really well. Okay, cholerics like to be challenged. They can easily accept difficult assignments, you know, find me reservations someplace, remodel a school. They're like, okay, we'll figure that out. But here's an interesting thing about clerics. When faced with a dilemma or a situation or a decision, maybe clerics almost instantly know what they would do with that. They make their decision quickly. And so compared to the other three personalities, they get to the decision much, much faster than anybody else, okay? But they also have a harder time shifting off of what that initial decision was. In their mind, they've made up their mind, this is what we should do. And it's hard for them to shift off of that, okay? Now, a melancholy is not that way. If a melancholy says, what if we did this, and somebody else offers an alternative, the melancholy compares the two and says, no, I think your idea is a better idea. And the melancholy will shift off of their idea to the better idea, because they analyze the two and they want to do it the best way, the right way, right? A choleric has a harder time getting there. So even if the choleric says, what if we do this? And the melancholy thinks of, you know, they start analyzing it and going, well, wait a minute, time out. Because if we do that, then this is going to happen and we'll need to have extra people to do that and that kind of stuff. And the melancholy may raise all kinds of issues that kind of challenge the choleric's decision to say, maybe we need to think that. The choleric has a hard time processing that and coming to the conclusion that we should change the decision, okay? Now, if the group does, the cleric will get there. They're not just stubborn. Just know that it's a brain wiring thing. They have a harder time shifting off of that initial idea. And so they'll get there, but they won't get there as fast as the other people. So be patient with the clerics. If they feel like they're being resistant or stubborn, it's not a stubborn personality. It's just the way their brains are wired in terms of decision like that. Cholerics can often seem like they have more than their share of energy. They're usually high energy people. I was thinking about this today, and because I just was working with two different women on our staff here, who both of whom are choleric, just wonderful cholerics. They get a ton of stuff done. They're great leaders. But I've noticed that when they walk, they both walk very fast and very deliberate. And if you know a choleric, they don't waste time. They're like always on their way to do something because there's something that needs to get done, right? And so, and that's great. So, you know, we have, both of our boys are choleric. And so raising kids is interesting, raising choleric kids, because when you, because they're resistant to somebody telling them what to do. Because cholerics want to have a sense of control. And so if we would say to, you know, our kids, okay, it's time to, you know, we're at church and they're little kids. And we'd say, okay, they're playing with their friends and it's time to go. They would be real resistant to that. But what we did then is we began this thing that we called the 2-minute warning. So we'd say to our kids, hey, 2-minute warning, we're going to leave here in 2 minutes, so be wrapping up what you're doing. Okay, they didn't, neither one of them wore watches or knew anything about time at that point. And so 2 minutes was whatever we said it was. And sometimes it was 10 minutes, and sometimes it was 50 minutes, and sometimes it was a minute, okay? But when we said that, we gave them 2 minutes. In that little realm of 2 minutes, whatever that was, they were in control because they could do what they wanted with that. And they had a sense of what was coming. And so we gave them just enough of a sense of control that we weren't yanking them out and say, okay, stop what you're doing now, come with me now. And so you have to be, you know, when you're dealing with cholerics, be sensitive to that. And for kids, that kind of thing, just giving them that little bit of information helps. Cholerics need to learn that questions are okay. And so if a choleric says, here's what I think we should do, and somebody says, well, time out, what about this? And I've got a question about that. That they're not, those are, that's how melancholies process the decision. Melancholies are going to want to, you know, dissect it and analyze it, and they're just getting comfortable with the decision by analyzing it. Clerics need to learn that that's okay. They're not challenging you and the whole decision. They're not, you know, they're not challenging your leadership and the decision. They just, that's how they process. They process stuff very, very differently. And clerics need to learn that projects are not more important than people, because clerics can get very task-oriented and be in this mindset that clerics will get more done than anybody else, but they'll often leave this like trail of body bags in their wake because they get a ton done and they forget about people in the meantime. Okay, so those are clerics. Across from the clerics are the phlegmatics. How many phlegmatics in here? See, not many hands go up because there's more phlegmatics than this, but most phlegmatics sit there and go, why do I have to raise my hand? What's he going to do if I don't raise my hand? Because the strong-willed cholerics gravitate towards phlegmatics who will agree with them and not cause any trouble. Because phlegmatics are easygoing, they're diplomatic, they think in terms of conserving energy. Why would I raise my hand if I don't have to? Their desire, their goal in life is to have peace. So phlegmatics are great listeners. They're real laid back. They're easygoing. Their motto in life is don't sweat the small stuff. You know, don't get all upset over small stuff. And, you know, and the second part of that is, and remember that everything is small stuff. Okay. So phlegmatics just are very, they're the ones that buy 10 to 20 boxes of Girl Scout cookies from every girl that comes to the door. Okay. Just because they can't say no. And she's so cute. She just lives down the street. And so they're very, very agreeable. Okay. They dislike risk. They dislike challenge and surprise, kind of like the melancholies. They don't like to be surprised. They like things to be predictable. And they require time, the thing, you know, in order to adjust to changes. Whereas melancholies, if there's going to be changes in what we're doing in the system, all that kind of stuff, they need information. Phlegmatics need time. It just takes time to process doing something differently. Because if I want to live life where everything is peaceful and easy, it's where everything is pretty much stays the same. Because anytime there's change, it disrupts the peace. And so it takes longer for a phlegmatic to adjust to that, okay? Phlegmatics work well under pressure. They're actually hard workers, diligent workers, especially in the presence of a strong leader. But in the absence of a strong leader, phlegmatics can have a tendency to procrastinate, okay? And so on a team, phlegmatics are, you know, diligent, hard workers. But they're going to do it at the direction of somebody else who's kind of motivating and leading the team. They're reserved, but they love being around people. They're actually very relational. And so the phlegmatic, you know, dad is the dad whose kids and grandkids, you know, come over for Thanksgiving, and he gets to just sit in his easy chair. And as long as everybody's getting along and everybody's having a good time and everybody's happy, then he's just in heaven, just sitting there watching it all. Doesn't need to be the center of attention, doesn't need to be in charge. He loves being in a room when everybody is there and everybody is doing well. And so, you know, you'll know a phlegmatic at, you know, if you go out to dinner with, you know, 8 people, the phlegmatic at the table is the one who says absolutely nothing the entire dinner, but has a great time. And afterwards you say, how was it? He goes, oh, it was awesome. I love being with those people. And the fact that he didn't have to say anything to keep the conversation going is even better. He got to just sit back and be with people that he loves and listen to them talk. And so phlegmatics just love to be with people when there's no conflict. And that's kind of the nature of it. Phlegmatics tend to have this kind of innate wit. They tend to be very funny. They don't say a lot, but they seem to say just the right thing at the right time. And if you know some people, I have some friends like that, that just, they don't say a whole lot, but when they do, everybody just looks at them and busts up laughing because they're like, that's hysterical. As opposed to sanguines, we just say stuff all the time, hoping something is funny in there. Okay. Phlegmatics are security-oriented. They like to create safety for themselves and for their spouses and their family because safety is, you know, peaceful and non-chaotic. And so a phlegmatic parent likes to create, and a phlegmatic spouse likes to create a home that is free of conflict and peaceful as well. At the same time, they can carry the weight of their world on their shoulders because a phlegmatic is everybody, it's everybody's counselor. He's such a great listener. She's such a great listener. And so the phlegmatic will listen, will be the one that friends call and say, can I tell you about what's going on with me? And they, of course, and they'll sit for hours and listen to the person and because they're so good at that. And yet they can then kind of begin to carry the weight of that around on them. And so it can be kind of oppressive to the phlegmatics. So you've got to be careful. And phlegmatics need to learn the word no. Because phlegmatics are so agreeable. Phlegmatics will agree to come help you pack and move your house just because you asked, even though they have a bunch of other stuff that they really should be doing. And so phlegmatics are so agreeable that they need to learn to say the word no. All right. Now, so when it comes to projects and decisions, we've got a group of people, maybe it's the people in this room, and we have to plan something, we have to do something. How it gets done and how we approach decisions and projects is very, very different. Okay, sanguines want to do things, what? The fun way, right? So we figure out something, we want to make sure we do it the fun way. So, you know, if we say we got to take down the tables and chairs when we're done here tonight, okay, the sanguines will instantly make a game of it. I know, let's divide into half and we'll have a contest and see who can go fastest. And the phlegmatics want to do things the easy way. The melancholies want to do things what? The right way. And you probably know the clerics want to do things my way. Exactly. All right. We had a staff person here once who, after doing this, said to somebody else on staff, said, you know what, I realized I'm a melancholy. Because I like doing things the right way. And they laughed and they said, no, you're not. You're choleric. You just think your way is the right way. And it was true. So let's say a group of sanguines said, hey, I got an idea. You know, it'd be fun. Because that sanguines always start everything. You know, it'd be fun. What if on the last night of Marriage Matters Rebuilders, we came early and we had like coffee and dessert. And so the sanguines are now, sanguines have a picture of everybody standing around laughing and talking and having dessert and coffee. And so that's a great idea. And the clerics right away step in and say, yeah, we can do that. In fact, I'll take charge. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have everybody with last name A through L, you're going to bring a dessert. And everybody with M through Q, you're going to make the coffee. And then R through Z, you're going to be the cleanup committee. So the clerics start not only organizing it, but assigning people their jobs, right? The melancholies get there and look at the buffet table that we've got for the coffee and desserts, and they go, whoa, we can't do, no, the cups have to go first, and then the condiments, and then the coffee, and then the condiments, and we got to have something under there, because if the coffee drips, it's just going to make a mess on the carpet. And so the melancholies come in and reorder the whole thing, and they make it look nice, okay? Sanguines, we just open up a big thing of coffee cups and just set them there. The melancholies take them out and make them stacks and nice and stuff. And the phlegmatics look around and go, coffee? I love coffee. No, but here's what the phlegmatics do. This is really true. Phlegmatics, in that process where we're all going to be doing a project and everybody's busy, the phlegmatics will come up to the leader or whoever and say, let me know how I can help. I'd be glad to help if you need help. And they mean it. But if there's, you know, suddenly everything's going and it doesn't seem to be need of help, they just look around and go, looks like they got it. because that's the way phlegmatics think, all right? So, and I was talking about ShareFest. So those of you that have been to ShareFest and been at one of the projects at a school or downtown or, you know, one of the other buildings that we've redone or a park or something, you know, you get there and there's a site leader. The site leader is always a choleric who, by design, who can organize people in that site, make things happen in a very short period of time, make sure that people get the right supplies that they need from the right people, and then you know, the melancholies are there, and they're great at painting, especially the detail stuff. The little, where there's got to be a fine line, you don't want to put a sanguine on that. You want to give the sanguine the roller or something like that, okay? Because the melancholies are the detail people. The sanguines just want to have fun. Here's how you can tell the sanguines at ShareFest. They're the ones that have paint all over themselves. And the people that they painted with also have paint on them because the sanguines were doing this to them. And then they take a giant group picture at the end of all the paint they got on themselves, right? And they just have a blast. The phlegmatics will do whatever they're asked to do, and they'll work really, really hard. They're great at doing the tasks. But we have to be careful not to put the phlegmatics alone. You know, you don't want to put the phlegmatic and say, here, you just paint this post by yourself, because they do much better in a group where they're motivated by the group and by a leader. Okay, so, and then even taking this profile, I always laugh at the person, I always laugh thinking about you doing the profile the week before we do this teaching. Because the sanguines are all, they're amped about it, because the sanguines are looking at the profile going, and they're already picturing, they haven't even taken the profile yet, they're already picturing the discussion you're going to have at the table. And they're thinking, oh, this is going to be fun. I can't wait to hear what the other people are. This is going to be great. So they get all excited about it. The clerics look at the booklet and they start disagreeing with it. And they're going, I wouldn't have asked it this way. I don't even know if I agree with this definition of this word. And so, you know, and then the melancholies, they're the ones that just go, oh, I'm just stuck. I've been for an hour trying to decide, am I this or am I this? I'm this at home, but I'm this at work. And how many did Gordy say could tie? Call Gordy, see how many, because I've got like four that need to tie. And so they get all, it takes them forever because they want to make sure it's right. And the phlegmatics, they're the ones that look at it and put it down and go, 40 questions. Oh, geez, how long is this going to take? I'll do it later. And now some of the phlegmatics are mad at me because there was that quick quiz that you could do really quickly. And I wish he'd told us that last week because it could have saved a lot of time and energy. All right, so here's what's really interesting. You would think that our weaknesses would be in the opposite area. So like for me as a sanguine, that my weakness would be that I don't have any melancholy in me. But actually our weaknesses are our strengths taken to extreme. And so for a sanguine, the weakness is the kind of spontaneous, don't care kind of thing taken to extreme can become irresponsible. You know, a choleric who is a take charge kind of a person, take that to extreme, they can become authoritative and power hungry. A melancholy who likes, you know, things in order and structured, take that to extremes, they become perfectionistic. You know, a phlegmatic who's very easygoing, take that to extreme, they can become procrastinators and lazy, all right? So our weaknesses are our strengths taken to extreme. Now, what if my secondary personality is opposite my first, my primary personality? So in other words, if I'm a sanguine, if that was my highest score, what if the profile shows that the next highest score is melancholy or vice versa? Or if I'm a phlegmatic, that my secondary score is choleric? Because you said they were supposed to be kind of next to each other, okay? Does that mean I need counseling? Yes. No, actually, that's not true. Because people can function in opposite personality quadrants due to circumstances in your life, okay? But I would say seldom. And I would never say never because I can't put that past God. I don't know what God. But seldom do we see people who are naturally personality matched in opposite quadrants. And so if your profile shows that you're in opposite quadrants, then I would encourage you to do some more work on that because it probably is saying something that would be helpful for you to know about yourself. All right? And sometimes it's motives that are hidden in our real personality. So for instance, I told you, Karen's a melancholy, I'm a sanguine. Which one of us do you think is always on time for everything, and which one of us tends to be late to stuff? You would think that as a sanguine, I would be the one that's always late to stuff, and Karen would be the one who is meticulously on time. Not true. I'm the one who's always early to stuff. One, because I was raised that way. But the other is because I'm a sanguine, I don't care what I look like when I get there. I don't care if I'm dressed or not dressed or even how I'm dressed. I just want to get there and be with people. And I don't want, you know, I don't want anybody to have to wait for me because I'm sanguine. On the other hand, Karen has a hard time leaving to go somewhere before everything is right, both in the house and herself as she's getting ready. She hates to be late, but she has a harder time getting to places on time than I do because her melancholiness, it gets so caught in making sure everything is right before we leave home. Does that make sense? Okay. There's a thing that Florence Littauer talks about called masking. And when you have that kind of opposite quadrant thing, that I would encourage, there's a whole chapter in this book on that. And the idea is sometimes we mask personalities that aren't our real personalities. Here's an example. Let's say you're a choleric, and as a choleric child, you grow up with two choleric parents, okay? That's World War III waiting to happen right there, okay? Because everybody wants to be. What choleric child that has choleric parents gets to exercise this? So just by sheer survival, the child growing up with choleric parents learns to function phlegmatic, learns to be very agreeable, because the alternative to not being agreeable to choleric parents is dangerous, okay? And so the child grows up learning to function very phlegmatically, then gets on his or her own and in marriage and those kind of things and is maybe here tonight, and there's now parts of your life that is allowing the real choleric in you to come out. But as you take the profile, there are still questions that you think about yourself and you answer them this way. But it's maybe because you learned to function at a time in your life when you needed to for survival, or somebody expected you to be this way, or whatever it was. And so if you have scores that are in opposite quadrants, I would say do some work on that, because there's a very good chance there's something in there that may tell you something about your past or not, all right? Now, when we look at personalities, we look at, as I said, we have backup styles, which means we all have some combination of partnered personalities, okay? And so when we talk about partnering personalities, like I said, I'm a sanguine choleric. My highest is sanguine, my next is choleric. Sanguine and choleric combine well because both are extroverted, both are optimistic, both outspoken. At their best, sanguine choleric are highly excitable, they're charming. Dealing with people energizes them, which is really true. You know, Karen is a melancholy, and one of the things that's different is being with people taxes her. She loves being with people. She's very relational. But when I'm out, like after something like this tonight, when I'm with all of you, I'll go home and I'm energized because I've been with people. And she's not. If she's been with people, that depletes her energy, and she needs to be by herself to kind of recharge and get back. So some of you understand all that, all right? Sanguine clerics are generally outspoken. Sanguine clerics want to have fun, but they want to be in charge of the games at the same time, okay? At their worst, they can be kind of domineering personalities. Now, the bottom half of the quadrant are phlegmatic, melancholies and phlegmatics, okay? And those combine well because they're both introverted. Notice that above the center line are extroverts. Below the center line are introverts. And melancholies and phlegmatics are both introverted, so that personality combines well. As I said, dealing with people wears them out. I remember early on in our marriage not understanding the personalities and being somewhere at a party or at a big function or something with all these people, and I would go home and I would just be energized. And Karen would just want to go off and be by herself. And I'm energized. I want to be with her because now I'm energized. Let's do something. Let's, you know. And she just wants to be by herself. And I'm like, are you mad at me? You know, did I do something? No. Are you mad at me? No. Well, you're mad at me. I'm not mad at you. Yes, you are. I will be mad if you don't stop bugging me, but I'm not. And so it was hard for me to understand that having been with people, although she loved it, it was energy tapping for her, and she needed to be by herself as an introvert to re-energize, which is exactly the opposite for me, all right? They're generally soft-spoken, phlegmatics and melancholies. At their best, they do things perfectly and on time, They're pleasant. They're non-confrontational. At their worst, their nitpicking nature can leave them depressed and drained to accomplish much of anything anyway. So we both have kind of our good side and our bad side to that. Now, another two that combine well are cholerics and melancholies. And they combine well to provide someone who is highly task-oriented, okay? And so they want to be in charge and make everything perfect in the task. And so at their best, this is the greatest achiever of all of the personality combinations, okay? At their worst, they can become bossy and manipulative because they're so task-oriented, okay? And they can get discouraged that nobody else has that same vision that they do, that nobody else is doing things right and on time. And then across from them are the other two personalities that combine well, and that's sanguines and phlegmatics. And they combine into a highly relationship-oriented person. Okay, so notice again, now on the right side of the midline are people who are task-oriented. On the left side of the midline are people who are people-oriented. So if you're a sanguine, you're a people-oriented extrovert. If you're a choleric, you're a task-oriented extrovert. If you're a melancholy, you're a task-oriented introvert. And if you're a phlegmatic, you're a people-oriented introvert. Okay, does that make sense? And so sanguines and phlegmatics combine well. They like to have fun as long as they don't have to go anywhere to do it. Okay, so the sanguine phlegmatic is the one that says, can we just stay home and watch a movie? I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to do anything. I just want to take it easy and have fun. Okay, sanguine phlegmatics are everybody's favorite friend. I have two sanguine phlegmatic friends that come to my mind right away, and you just love to be with them because they're fun and they're agreeable and they're easygoing. They can tend to be undisciplined and sarcastic, and they can easily forget their responsibilities, but charm somebody else into doing their responsibilities for them. Okay, so that's sanguines and phlegmatics. Now, there's a lot more that we could talk about when it comes to like the emotional needs of the four different personalities, and that's helpful, and the needs in crisis and stress and depression. And so we put some of that information in appendixes for you after the notes are over for you to go back and look at that. I think that's some really helpful stuff. We'll let you just kind of do that on your own. And so what I want to do is just talk about right now, what if I'm married? One of the questions, what if I'm married to somebody with the same personality? Or dating somebody or parenting somebody with the same personality. And so there's often this joyful compatibility, but two sanguines in the same marriage are both looking for an audience and dying for attention. And so that doesn't necessarily link up perfectly. Two cholerics both want to be in charge and have things done their way so they can actually butt heads, even though they're both the same personalities. Two melancholies, you would think two melancholies would be like the match made in heaven, right? They both want order and structure and a place for everything and everything in its place. The problem is they have different pictures sometimes of what that looks like, different standards for what order looks like. And then two phlegmatics together, they don't care if anything gets done on time and they hope the other person does it. And so that can cause both, you know, a joyful marriage and problems at the same time. Let me talk real quickly about one of the common dilemmas that I see in marriages. And this may be true for you, or you may know somebody where this is. And this is where you have a choleric wife and a phlegmatic husband. Both created that way by God, a choleric wife that God has wired to be a take charge, get stuff done, kind of a person, leader, and a man who has been wired by God to be easygoing, easy-natured, you know, peaceful, those kind of things. And yet, God has called us in marriage for the men to take a leadership role. Not power, not authority, but leadership. And I've had couples sit in my office who are this, where the woman is a cleric, and there's a frustration level on her part because she feels like he's not leading. And I want to have a godly marriage, and I want him to lead. And the problem is, he doesn't need to. Because she leads just fine. In fact, if he starts to lead, she takes over. And he gets to the point where he just goes, well, why even try? It seems like it works fine when she's leading and charge. But there's this tension that kind of naturally happens because that's not the way God sets it up. Now, what's the answer to that? I don't know. And when I talked to a couple with that situation, I said, I don't know what the solution is, but you need to talk about it. You need to figure that out. Because that's going to be a constant tension in your marriage that will, you know, wreak havoc on you unless you come to some ideas of what you want to do with that, all right? What about a situation where you've got a choleric, melancholy husband who's very task-oriented? In fact, life is measured through the lens of what we get done, how much we get done, and how smoothly things go while we're doing them. And he's married to a sanguine, phlegmatic wife who is highly relational, and she longs for more closeness with her husband, and she drops hints, and she even initiates relational closeness with him, but he just never seems to get it. And finally, she gets so frustrated that no matter what she does, he just seems distant and task-oriented, and she finally just decides she can't take it anymore, and so she leaves him. And you talk to him, and he says, I thought everything was doing just fine. I had no idea there was a problem. Because they're just so functioning. They have such different perspectives on marriage and what going fine means. For him, going fine means task. For her, going fine means relationship. So you just have to be really, really careful about that, all right? Finally, I just want to leave with a few observations about personalities, and then we'll let you go to your small groups. The first one is this. Personalities are not a function of intelligence. There isn't one of the four that is more intelligent than the others, okay? Intelligence is a completely different scale. All four of those are equally capable of being intelligent as the others, all right? Second one is that personalities are not an excuse to not do things that we should do, okay? Being a sanguine is not an excuse for me to leave my dirty underwear all over the floor and socks and just go, well, sorry, that's just the way God made me. You know, get used to it. Third, personalities are not boxes to put people in. Oh, well, yeah, well, she's just a sanguine. She's just he's just a choleric. He's a melancholy. Of course he's going to act like it. They're not labels or boxes to put people in. Hopefully to help us understand and appreciate people, but not to label and categorize people. Fourth, we need to learn to love and serve our spouse based on their personality. And again, this is one of those cases where it's not about hoping that they'll just kind of come to terms with who we are, but understanding and appreciating who they are and then loving them based on their personality. So for instance, I'm a sanguine, I don't care if the bed ever gets made. Because I live by that motto that, well, we're just going to sleep in it again tonight, right? I mean, why? Nobody's going to see it. And I don't care if there's clothes on the floor, that kind of stuff. I like a house that's picked up. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Karen loves to keep a nice house. I appreciate that. I love that. It's not in my wiring, okay? But I don't care if the bed ever gets made, but she does. And I care about her. And so I know how to make the bed. In fact, I even pretty much know what order all those useless pillows go in. And where to put them and where to put the divot in them. And I can actually do all that stuff. It seems stupid to me, but I can do it, okay? I don't care, but I care about her, and she cares about that, okay? So I can learn to pick up after myself and to do that. And when I do it, I know that I'm doing it because this matters to her. I remember, you know, talking about the boating story that one time, not too long after the first one where Karen said, can we clean up before we went? We were having dinner. It's a very similar situation. We're having dinner at the kitchen table, and it was a beautiful night, and starting to get dark a little bit, so we knew we didn't have much time. And I said, hey, let's go. It's a beautiful night. Let's go for a boat ride. And so the boys very carefully pick up their plate, and they start going to the kitchen sink. And Karen says, wait, there's not much sun. There's not much daylight left. Let's just go now. Leave everything. We'll clean up when we come back. And the boys look at her, and they look at me, and they look at her, and they and so in that moment, I realized that she was intentionally loving us based on our personalities. And she said, let's go now. If you guys will agree to help me clean up the kitchen when we get back, let's just all go for the boat ride now. And so we did, and we came back, and we helped her clean up. And so what we've learned in our marriage is to appreciate the other person and then to intentionally do stuff based on their personality and to love them based on their personality. And then finally, the goal is to free you to become the person that God created you to be. One last story, and then I'll let you go. For years, I worked with Young Life and spent a lot of my summers at Young Life camps and leading teams there and One of the things that I did when I was the camp director and leading a whole team where we had, you know, probably 15 adults on the team and then a bunch of college kids and a bunch of high school kids and about 500 people in the camp total. But the 15 adults and their spouses that I would lead, I got in the habit of, because we'd be together for 4 weeks and most of us didn't know each other before the month together. And about halfway through, I would have everybody take the personality profile, the same one that you just did. And then we'd have we'd spend an evening together just talking about what you and I have just talked about. And it was really intriguing because now we'd been working and living together in some pretty tense situations. And so we'd really gotten to know each other. And so it was really fun to kind of then see each other's personalities kind of defined. And then that kind of set the tone for the next 2 weeks where we could kind of function as a team taking personalities into account. I remember this one summer, there was a woman on our staff named Jay, really talented young woman, who was very musical. She'd been in theater, and she was funny, and she was one of our program directors. And she was just, I mean, she was so funny up on stage. We loved her. We howled. And so we're taking the personality profile, and everybody just assumed, you know, she's sanguine, and she's such an extrovert. And she was a very strong melancholy. And we all just kind of went, really? And she starts explaining it. And she said, yeah, I'm good on stage, but I'm not an extrovert. She said, I've been in drama and that kind of stuff my whole life. And we talked about a bunch of stuff. And then I looked over and the tears were just streaming down her face. And I remember stopping and just going, Jay, what's going on? Because we just kind of, you know, we all kind of embraced her. And she said, All my life, I have functioned. People have expected me to be the life of the party. And that's not who I am. And she said, it still gets me. She said, tonight, for the first time in my life, I feel like I have permission to be who God made me to be. And my hope for you, maybe for the very first time, tonight when you hear this, maybe some of you, that you begin to realize that you have permission to be who God made you to be. You are, your personality is exactly the way God intended it to be, and it's wonderful, just the way you are. And when we become comfortable with our own personality and begin to understand and appreciate the personalities of others, our spouses, our kids, other people, we begin to set the stage to greatly improve our relationships.